Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, my name is Anthony Bubalo. I'm the research director here at the Lowy Institute, and it's my pleasure to be hosting our conversation today about Michael Fullilove's Boyer lectures, and in fact, his lectures that have now been serialised into a book, A Larger Australia, which is out this week, courtesy of Penguin. Thank you all for coming today. I'd like to welcome in particular one of our board members, and in fact, two. A current chairman of the ABC and a former chairman of the ABC sitting in the front row. It's a great pleasure to have you here with us today and have you all here with us for what should be a very special discussion. In October of this year, Michael Fullilove delivered the... Nothing about Freudian slips. Michael Fullilove delivered the 2015 Boyer Lecture. It was one of the rare occasions where the Boyers had diverted into international policy, foreign policy. The last time was when Owen Harries delivered his fabulous Boyer Lectures on American power in 2003. So it was great, particularly for an international policy think tank, to have the Boyer Lectures dedicated to what is obviously a core theme in our work. Specifically, Michael was tasked to look at Australia's place in the world. And his lectures examined both the challenges that Australia faces in the world, but also it set out what Australia needs to do to meet some of those challenges. And so today we're going to discuss some of those themes with Michael, but also with our other distinguished panellists. We have, of course, Michael here. Michael doesn't require any introduction, but he usually likes one. He writes widely, of course, on Australian foreign policy, but in particular US foreign policy and global issues. He's written for the New York Times, the Financial Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Policy, the National Interest and Foreign Affairs. A year usually doesn't pass without him writing a book. As you all know, the executive director here at the Lowy Institute. We also have with us today Tom Switzer, who is a lecturer at the University of Sydney at the US Study Centre and in his spare time hosts Between the Lines on ABC's Radio National. He's a former editor of The Spectator Australia, a former editor at The Australian and the Australian Financial Review, and was for a time with the Washington-based American Enterprise Institute. Tom has written for the Wall Street Journal, for the New York Times, for Foreign Affairs, the American Interest, and for the National Interest. We're also joined today by Anna Funder. Of course, we have way too many foreign policy wonks in our panel, so it's a real delight to host a non-foreign policy wonk. Anna is known to everyone, of course, as one of Australia's most acclaimed and awarded writers. Her 2012 novel, All That I Am, won the Miles Franklin Prize, along with the West Australian Premier's Prize, the West Australian Premier's People's Choice Prize, the Barbara Jeffries Prize, the Indie Book of the Year, Indie Best Debut Fiction, the Australian Book Industry Award, and the ABIA Literary Fiction Book of the Year, and the Nielsen Book Data Booksellers Choice Award. A lot of awards.
We got it.
That's just great.
But of course, Anna first made her name with a book of non-fiction, Stasiland, which has been hailed as a classic and won the 2004 Samuel Johnson Prize. So we have a fantastic panel. We're going to start off by me shooting them some questions and trying to get a bit of a conversation and maybe even a debate going. And then I'll turn to the audience and take a few questions from you all. I wanted to start with Michael's first lecture. The first lecture really is the scene setter. Michael's talking about the current world that we're living in and the challenges that we face. And I think it's fair to say that it's a fairly bleak assessment of the world. Michael talks about the kind of the challenges of Islamic State, the challenges, the potential challenges of a rising China, the great changing strategic dynamics in our own region, and it's interesting. Michael's first lecture came out at a time of leadership change in Australia, where you also, I suppose, had a change in outlook, where Prime Minister Turnbull talked about, you know, there's no better time to be an Australian, kind of a markedly more optimistic outlook on the world than his predecessor. I want to start with you, Michael. I mean, as I said, it was a fairly bleak outlook on the world. Why have you presented that way? And does that mean that you're kind of pessimistic about the future as well?
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you, Tom and Anna, for coming today. It's very, very special indeed. If Malcolm Turnbull had given the Boyer lectures, as you said, he probably would have given a more rosy picture. I think when I think about the world, I think I do so with a mix of optimism and pessimism. I think at the global level, it's hard not to be a little anxious, although certainly not fearful, about some of the changes we see. At the global level, the liberal international order, of which we have been a beneficiary for many decades, is becoming daily less liberal, less international, and less orderly. The United States has inched back from the world. There are strong state challenges, Russia, China, and Iran, to name three. There are strong non-state challenges, and we see Islamic State changing its methodology and certainly having a strategic influence on the world. You see a planet that continues to heat up. You see more refugees now than at any time since the end of the Second World War, an exodus of refugees, I called it, from Middle East conflicts going to Europe. So I think, and you get international institutions that are showing their age, that are pretty creaky and unable to deal with these issues. So I think I wanted to be not pessimistic about that, but to be clear-eyed and to look at it straight in the face. I think in our region, I think there's certainly more cause for optimism. Our region represents, I think the figure is half of global GDP, but two-thirds of global growth. So the growth story is much stronger in our part of the world. This creates exhilarating opportunities for us if we are agile enough, as the Prime Minister says, to deal with it. But there are also security problems in our own region. We see all the time now tensions in China's near seas. We have problems on the Korean Peninsula. We have a cat's cradle of bilateral tensions in the region. That's why in one of the lectures I say that the tyranny of distance has been replaced by the predicament of proximity. It's a predicament because we are closer to the action, both for good and for ill. There's upside for us, but downside. So, to answer your question, I think at the regional level, there's more cause for optimism. But taken as a whole, it's an arresting world. It's a world that demands more of our attention, more of our thinking, and it certainly requires the optimism and agility that Mr. Turnbull talks about. And I think that was a welcome change, but it also needs some realism and some strength.
Tom, when you look out at the world, and you spend a lot of time looking at the world and interviewing people on your program, I mean, what do you see? Are you pessimistic about the state of the world? Are you worried?
No, not as pessimistic as Michael. I mean, I think that Michael is right to talk about the end of the post-war order that Dean Acheson and America's great diplomats in the post-war order created and that has benefited Australia dramatically. That order is no more. Power has become more diffuse. There is more multipolarity, which means that more nations have an ability to veto collective action to solve the world's problems. I think all of that's true. But I would turn to Kishore Mahbubani, the distinguished Singaporean diplomat who wrote a book a few years ago called The Global Convergence. And he highlighted in great detail how the world has actually become more prosperous than ever on a wide range of issues. We have an ability to solve world epidemics better now than we ever have. In terms of wars, believe it or not, since the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 up until 2013-14, when he was writing, there were less wars than there had been during the previous 25 years. So I take a more optimistic view, and I am particularly optimistic. This is where I would distinguish myself from Michael, because I think Michael's highlighted some serious problems in Australia, and we can talk about that in a moment, such as this leadership churn. But I think that all things considered, Australia is in a much better position than many countries in the world, particularly many Western countries. You just look at the United States right now, a country I cover in great detail. You know, we don't have any Donald Trumps. I think the American people are... I mean, we don't. We've had a Clive Palmer, and he's quickly fading. I mean, Trump has a very good chance, believe it or not, of winning the Republican presidential nomination. And I think this is because the American people are in a profoundly foul mood. You go to Western Europe, look at Marine Le Pen and the National Front. We don't have anything like that in Australia.
But doesn't that worry you? I mean, in the sense that, okay, Australia might be in a good circumstance, but you've got the Marie Le Pens,
sure,
you know, in France, the Donald Trumps. Doesn't yep. that worry you that you know, outside of Australia, you know, the world,
yeah, I think,
and the things that we relied on are crumbling?
Yeah, I mean, certainly when it comes to many of these liberal democracies in Western Europe, the United States, there is a loss of faith in the political institutions, in the political elites. And I think there is a search for radical alternatives. That's not really evident here. That is a problem to some extent. And I think, you know, the question is, why is this happening? I just think a lot of the folks in these countries worry about Islamic terrorism, economic problems in these countries that haven't really afflicted Australia. And I think that the breakdown in the traditional media has changed things a lot too. It's been a good thing and a bad thing.
We'll come back to broken politics and terrorism in a moment. Anna, I wanted to ask you, so the policy wonks will debate about, you know, whether there have been fewer or more wars, whether we're richer or poorer now. But just from your perspective as a writer, as someone that's lived for the last, you know, 3.5 years in the US, when you look out at the world, what do you see? Are you fearful? Are you optimistic? Are you a bit of both?
I'm glad you say that I'm not a policy wonk. I don't think I'm a wonk of any kind. I aspire to be, but I'm nowhere near there. I'm very happy to be here today, and I'd like to thank Michael and Lowy for asking me to come. Just as a novelist, I tend to notice details of things, so less to do this overview of optimism and pessimism about world affairs, although I was briefly quite a bad international lawyer in another life. So there's a kind of residual element where I love to read this and I love to think about it. What I notice most coming back from the US is you, Tom, talk about dissatisfaction with Western European governments and in the US. That's true, but they are drastically different sorts of dissatisfaction because no one in Europe says there shouldn't be government. Whereas in America, there's a very strong long tradition of anti-government at all of any description. So the social contract there is very different from Western Europe and from here again. So I notice when I come back that Australia is incredibly wealthy. We had to buy a car. You know, there's a huge amount of money just riding around on wheels in this country, kind of ridiculous amount of money. And a very, we've maintained a very large, I don't know what the statistics on it are, but a very solid middle class and upper middle class, and a lot of educated young people from across the class spectrum. Whereas in the States, the middle class has really been very squashed, is much thinner, much poorer. I was living in a well-to-do bit of, you know, Brooklyn, but I really noticed people doing it quite hard, professional people doing it hard, and that reflects in having... So this is New York, this is not across the board in America, but people having fewer children and really scraping to have a kind of lifestyle that we would consider normal. Mm. And that is combined with a very strong sense of mistrust of government, mm-hmm. which pervades both Democratic and Republican mm-hmm. sides of government. So a tiny little metaphor, we were there for Hurricane Sandy at the end of 2012, which came through in October. I was stuck doing a book tour in LA and my husband holed up in our apartment with three kids, a friend from London and a case of wine. So I was wandering around the streets of LA in the sunshine, very worried about it. This hurricane came through and, of course, they were fine. They had their wine and their Netflix and whatnot. But trees came down, Manhattan flooded. It was apocalyptic in Manhattan across the river. There were no public services. There was no SES to go in. The Red Cross went in to New York City. So when you think about instances like that, it becomes very clear that there's no faith in public infrastructure and consequently a vastly diminished public infrastructure from our point of view. Mm. So That's a broad overview of what I notice about here.
And what about things like terrorism? I mean, it's in the news. We saw the terrible attacks in Paris and more recently in the US. You know, when you look at those things, does it make you more fearful, or do you think we don't see the threat with the right perspective anymore?
I don't know how much sense there is in being fearful. I mean, of course we're fearful, but there's very little that we can actually do beyond keep an eye on what sorts of powers we give our security services internally, because the threat is going to come as much, if not more, from giving those powers and liberties, those powers to them and those liberties away, as from the terrorists about whom we can do nothing. So I was very impressed by the French point of view after Charlie Hebdo, and also after these most recent horrific attacks, which is, we are back on the streets, we're back in the cafes, we are not going to cauterize our lifestyle, because that is what you want. And I think there's something very powerful in that response.
Yeah. It's something, again, we'll touch on in more detail in a moment. Michael, I mean, so Tom said, you know, we're richer, there are fewer wars. How do you reconcile that with your view that the world is still a very challenging place?
Look, I think, Tom makes important points. I think the point about the decline in the number of wars and the decline in the number of battlefield casualties is not an argument that can be sustained at the end of 2015. I mean, Steven Pinker wrote that famous book about how the world's getting better, but I think an update to that book now, after hundreds of thousands of dead in Syria, with a Middle East that is basically collapsing as a state system, with four civil wars, four proxy wars, hundreds of thousands of killed, millions displaced, I think that rosy view of the picture is not quite as accurate as it was a few years ago. Tom also, I think, usefully pointed to the strength, Australia's strengths compared to other Western countries, and I don't disagree with that. In fact, one of the arguments that I'm making in the book is that we too often and too easily talk ourselves down. We always say, well, what are Australia's strengths anyway? We're just this tiny little country at the bottom end of the world, and what would Mr. Putin care if we say this or that? Why are we running for the UN Security Council? We've got tickets on ourselves. I don't think we have tickets on ourselves. I think we should recognise that we are a successful country with a strong economy, with good institutions, and we can play a significant role in the world. But the weakness of Western countries to which you point is, to me, something we should be worried about, because since Australia was established, we have always seen ourselves as implicated in the great global game. We've always thought to ourselves, we've always believed that we have a stake in the global balance of power. That's why Australia has participated in conflicts all over the world, from the Sudan to the Boxer Rebellion in China and the Sinai and Palestine and all over the world. And you may disagree with some of those deployments, but to now have a situation where the confidence of Western countries is drooping, where, as Anna says, to go to the United States and to see its shocking infrastructure and its broken politics and the rise of clowns like Donald Trump to really leading positions in the polity, to go to France and see the success that the National Front are having, to see populist, destructive governments in a lot of countries that we would regard as friends and allies, even to see the United Kingdom step back from the foreign policy front line. I mean, I think this week the House of Commons voted to join the airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria. But to any student of British foreign policy and British politics, the idea that it would take the Brits 2 years to come to this conclusion is amazing. The idea that you could have an opposition leader in Britain that is not sure that Britain should be a member of NATO, that is not sure that Britain should be a member of the European Union, that is not sure that Britain should have a nuclear deterrent, signals something that is changing in the fibre of the West. And our Western identity has always been, as I say in the lectures, one of the dimensions of our foreign policy. And I think if the confidence of Western countries is drooping, then that has big implications for us in the future. And we can't just say, well, we'll be right, Jack, because we're doing well compared to those countries. I think their destiny and our destiny is tied up with each other.
Which brings us to the domestic politics question, and it was a big feature of you devoted one entire lecture of a four-series lecture on foreign policy, domestic policy, politics, and you started with the line that foreign policy begins at home. And you know, the one point of weakness you said for Australia was that you think our domestic politics is broken. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Well, look, I think there is a problem with leadership churn, and Michael quite succinctly points out the various case studies at both the federal level and at the state level. I mean, what is it? We've had five prime ministers now in 5 years. We've had, what, six defence ministers in 8 years?
Mm-hmm.
How many premiers have we had in New South Wales in 5 years?
We're on our sixth in a decade.
Sixth in a decade. Victoria?
Fourth in 5 years. Queensland is on its third premier in 4 years.
I mean, this is obviously a quite dramatic change and upheaval, and that is not ideal. But I do think that in the book, Michael places more emphasis on the problems with our political class and not on more structural problems like the media. I think here in this country we are more poll-driven than most Western liberal democracies. I think the news cycle here, I think it's actually quite more relentless here than it is in, say, the United States. The United States has a lot of rubbish on the 24-hour, 7-news cycle. We have Sky News, we have ABC 24. I think people are very much attuned to Twitter and social media, and they help drive the news agenda. And I think that increasingly policy issues aren't getting the kind of attention that they used to. Now, this is a problem, but I'm not sure what the actual answer is. And I think, having said that, despite these problems, Australia is, by any criteria, a fairly successful country. We haven't had a recession in this country in 25 years. That is extraordinary. And we often downplay that. We haven't had 2 quarters of negative growth in 25 years. I think the Netherlands probably are about that, but that's about it. I mean, the United States has had 2 serious downturns during that period. And socially, it's a fairly stable and prosperous society. We have our problems, but we don't have the race riots that are all too often evident in many parts of Europe and indeed in the United States. So I just come here as an optimist. I think that all things considered, despite the problems we have with our political system and the churning, I think by any criteria, we're a very successful and prosperous society. And I think in the eyes of the world, Australians are relaxed, comfortable, and at ease with themselves, which makes it very strange that some intellectuals in this country, not so much Michael, but some people constantly think that the world is constantly reacting to events here and scrutinising us. It reminds me of something our old friend Owen Harries once said: for extended periods of time in many parts of the world, you need very good peripheral vision to see Australia. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think we have more prestige and influence today than we ever have.
Well, Anna, you spent the last 3 years living in the world. Tell us how the world sees us, at least one part of the world.
Well, I've got a question first. I'm quite interested in this political churn. If we're so relaxed and comfortable, why are we churning over the leaders so often? I mean, I haven't been here, but it has been, it's been interesting to watch. A little embarrassing. I mean, you know, you watch Italy and then you watch Australia.
Do people ask you about it in the US? I mean, I've heard some wag describe Australia as the most unstable country in the South Pacific. But do people ask you about it in the US? Are they scratching their heads going, who was the Prime Minister this week?
I don't think they look very much to Australia, to be perfectly honest, sad to say. But I am interested, Michael, why do you think that we don't trust our politicians or we don't invest them with enough respect to leave them there to be able to do something?
This is where Anthony should jump in and say, like Lee Sales did too, in this panel I asked the questions. But I'm delighted to answer it, so thank you. I mean, why is a big question. I mean, first of all, does it matter, which is the point that Tom's getting to? I think it does matter. I think it's true that over the last 20-odd years we've had good economic success, but the truth is since 2007 we've had way too many prime ministers. I mean, the churn in ministerial offices has been extreme. This obviously affects their ability to run long-term initiatives. And you can see that. I mean, it's very difficult to point to that many significant reforms that have been passed by either party since 2007. And those that were subsequently pulled down by the other side. And I'm thinking of Labor's ETS here. So I think it does. I think it's not best practice to be constantly churning governments. Why it happens is hard to answer. I mean, it's possible, for example, that it's all down to the pollies, that the quality of politicians or leaders that we are producing is not up to what we've historically had. I mean, if you think of Hawke, Keating, Howard, these were three pretty impressive leaders. So that's one possible answer. I think the culture of politics is part of the problem. I think the relentless negativity that Mr. Abbott excelled in, it must be said. I think
more than Malcolm Fraser 40 years earlier.
Perhaps that's right, but we saw I think Fraser was better able to transition to government than Mr. Abbott was. He was able to grow in a way beyond the rancour of the dismissal, although there was still a lot of animosity towards him. I don't think Mr. Abbott was able to do that, which is why his party turfed him out. So I think there's something about the culture in politics, but I think also we have to, you know, that old phrase, physician, heal thyself. I mean, we're constantly criticising our politicians and complaining about them, but surely we are accessories in all this. I mean, there's something where, as you know, Tom, you talked about polls, where we lose patience so quickly. As soon as expectations are not met completely, then the politician, the leader, loses support so quickly, and then before you know it, the pressure's on in the party room for a political change. So somehow, as a public, we've lost patience, and at the same time, our political class have become seemingly less skilled at making a long-term coherent argument and being able to bring the country along.
But picking up something that Tom said, though, I mean, the role of the media and the relentlessness of the media cycle, surely that works both ways. I mean, yes, the media cycle is faster. Yes, it's more relentless. Yes, it seems more... the kind of questioning seems more superficial. But surely, at this time in history, there is no better moment for a politician to get their message out, to actually have a conversation with individuals, bypassing the media, if you like, through social media, through those things. Is it a bit rich for politicians to be complaining?
No, I don't think so, because politicians can get out on the hustings and make the case. And you're right, there's more opportunities for politicians to do that. But there are far more opportunities to bring down those proposals. And I think that's what all too often happens in the debate. And I'm not sure what the answer is. But I don't think that this necessarily is a problem. I think actually one consequence of these boom times in Australia, you know, we've seen no recession in 25 years, it's social stability, a lot of progress despite some problems. You don't want to sugarcoat the housing market and things like that. But nevertheless, I think all things considered, compared to the rest of the world, we do pretty well. I think one of the consequences of that is that the public is probably more inclined to dispense with leaders very quickly, whereas if there was a sense of crisis, if there was more upheaval in the society, they may well be more likely to support a long-term leadership. We'll wait and see. But I don't think that the political class itself... I mean, Paul Kelly, the distinguished journalist at the Australian, no stranger here to the Lowy Institute, he's even raised doubts that a Hawke or a Keating or even a Howard could cope in this relentless 24/7. It's not even 24/7. It's this relentless media, cable, Twitter cycle. And the fact that Kelly says that about those political giants and their ability to cope in today's circumstances says a lot.
I think Keating would have... Some of Keating's bon mots would have worked quite well on Twitter, actually. but look, I think we have a test now. I mean, we have a test case, and that's Malcolm Turnbull. Mm-hmm. And, let's see how he goes. I mean, it's interesting, I think, how the positive, optimistic approach that he has brought, although obviously that suits his political interests and his agenda in getting re-elected, but that does seem to have changed the tone of Australian politics very quickly. I mean, almost overnight, actually, when Turnbull got up to the dispatch box and showed a little bit of humour in Parliament and a bit of optimism, he seemed to wrench back the initiative in a way that Mr. Abbott was unable to do so. Although I thought Mr. Abbott did some good things in foreign policy, when you think back to his prime ministership, it did feel a bit like one of those long-distance polypedals that's pretty joyless and where willpower and absolute determination alone was almost getting him there. And you saw with Turnbull just a willingness to be a bit light about it, not to constantly invoke the death cult, to speak in a slightly different way. I mean, I don't agree with everything Elizabeth Farrelly said in that City Morning Herald article, but I do think that it's an interesting test case now as to whether a different approach, fewer public appearances than Abbott, refusing to play the rule in, rule out things. Let's see if this is sustainable. This will tell us. I mean, if a very popular politician like Malcolm Turnbull, with a lot of goodwill behind him, can't make it happen, if we're here in a year or 2 years, having cycled through a couple more prime ministers, then I think the answer is more likely to be a sort of a systemic problem rather than something to do with these individual leaders.
It's a different leadership style. So you've got a style of politics that appeals to people's fears, which I think you saw in Abbott and certainly in John Howard as well. Or this is a different style, which doesn't. It appeals to our intelligence and our confidence and our optimism. So that's, I think, we're seeing, looking at those as different sides of that coin to see, you know, this is a very educated, intelligent country. Let's see how he goes appealing to us on that basis. I mean, sometimes I wonder whether, as you say, this churn might be a sign of the relative prosperity and success of Australia, that we don't need our politicians. Not that I would wish some disaster on us to have, you know, a leader come to the front. But I wonder whether part of it isn't deep down this terrific and wonderful tradition of egalitarianism that you touch on as well in the lectures, but it has a flip side, which is of bringing down the great and the good as well. It's an anti-authoritarianism that is the sometimes very dark flip side of our egalitarianism. And to think, I always think of that terrible 100-year-old joke where there are three men digging a ditch and the boss drives by. Do you know this? An Englishman, an American, an Australian, and the boss drives by in his Bentley, and the Englishman says, "Top car," and the American says, "One day I'm going to get me one of those," and the Australian says, "One day that bastard's going to be back down here in this ditch where he belongs." And I think of that quite frequently when I look at things like this churn, because it's terrific that we're all equal and we're all on a first name basis, and coming back from the States you notice it, or coming back from Germany where I very much enjoy being Frau Funder. I like the egalitarian nature of it. But I think that that means that respect comes, people feel that perhaps great respect comes at the price somehow of our self-respect, when it doesn't at all. But it's just that we're not so used to being able to respect politicians as many great and good, actually. And I think that's something that could change under Malcolm.
Where a lot of you can, if I can. I mean, one or a couple of concrete examples of this dark side of egalitarianism are, I mean, the constant negativity and the constant, almost obsession with the entitlements and the travel and the telephones of politicians. Now, of course, some of those things are indefensible. Helicopter rides to Geelong are probably not absolutely necessary, but still, I mean, do people? I mean, it seems that some of our media and some of our fellow countrymen and women think that constant phone calls and constant travel is some wonderful perk that politicians have earned. The truth is, it's a nightmarish way to live, to be constantly on the road and away from your families and living in Canberra and constantly on the mobile phone. And yet, although they've got great bookshops in Canberra, and I wouldn't slight the citizens of that country in any way. But I mean, yes, of course, we should be careful with the public money, but I often think, really, can't we think a little bit bigger than this? I mean,
but to the extent that you're right, this suggests it's not so much a politician problem, it's a public problem.
Well, and it touches on where, you know, at Michael's last lecture, where he talks about a little bit about, you know, it's almost the tall poppy syndrome about ourselves, and it's about this unwillingness of us to push ourselves forward and this almost sense of insecurity about how good we are and whether we can perform.
Hang on. Tony Abbott all too often got knocked on foreign policy issues, and although I'm a great admirer of Tony, I'm a friend of Tony's, I didn't agree with some of his foreign policy decisions, but they're the foreign policy decisions that Michael, in his thesis, supports. Australia was the first country to come out supporting the United States airstrikes against the Islamic State in Iraq in August 2014. Shortly before then, in July of last year, Abbott was very forceful in his criticism of the Russian aggression in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine. Of course, it led to the downing of the Malaysian aircraft. Now, I think that in both cases, it didn't make sense for an Australian leader to go out and be so hawkish. I mean, the Islamic State's a classic case in point. This is ultimately a sectarian Sunni Shia war. On the one hand, you've got Islamic State and Al-Qaeda who have been aided and abetted by the Turks and the Saudis over the last few years, and they're fighting a bunch of Shia militia who were aided and abetted by mullahs in Tehran. Now, this is ultimately over who should be the prophet to Muhammad. I'm not sure how a 1,300-year-old sectarian stoush is in the Australian national interest, but here was Tony Abbott leading, punching above our weight.
But surely there are two things.
Making here. A larger
there are
Australia.
Things,
why?
There are two things here, Tom. One is, and Michael can answer this in a moment, but one is the verities of the particular issues on which we choose to be ambitious. One is the general proposition that we should be ambitious, we should play a role in the world. Are you saying that we should pull back from the world,
sit on the ramparts? Australia is a middle power. I know Michael disagrees, but I think we have a population of 23, 24 million people. We spend less than 2% of the GDP on defence. I think it's something like 1.4, 1.5%. We have an army of 25,000. The idea that Australia should be a major player in the Russia's sphere of influence or in this mess in Potamia strikes me as stark raving mad. And I just think this is a classic case of where I think Australia has national interest and we'd be better focused, frankly, on reordering foreign policy priorities more in our region and engaging with Asia rather than trying to be players in the Middle East or in Russia's sphere of influence.
So, Michael, are you stark raving mad?
Will that increase book sales? Look, I think Tom sets up an artificial dichotomy. Either we've got to be a major player in politics in Russia's sphere of interest, or we should focus on Asia. No. What I would say is that we are a beneficiary of the liberal international order, and we benefit when there is a functioning liberal international order. We benefit when planes are not shot down from the sky. We benefit when leaders like Mr. Putin are not given license to arm proxies to interfere in the affairs of their neighbours, indeed to annex territory. I mean, he annexed territory. He broke that fundamental rule of the international state system since the end of the Second World War. That's not in our interest that sort of activity be allowed to continue. So I don't say that we should be deploying thousands of troops to the Ukraine, far from it. But the specific example you brought up was the way that Mr. Abbott conducted himself after the shooting down of MH17. We had absolutely clear national interest there because we had dozens of Australian dead littering the ground in eastern Ukraine. And if Mr. Abbott had done what you recommend, then he would have kept his head down, we wouldn't have said anything, and things would have gone on. But I respect the fact that Mr. Abbott stood up, he put Putin's feet in the fire, he said this is ultimately Russia's, this ultimately springs from Russia and we need to focus on that, and he affected the tone of the debate. That's not to say we achieved everything we did, but by throwing his weight, by throwing Australia's weight into a global issue, we made a contribution. That's not to say we want to be deploying troops in Ukraine, but to say that we should draw back and we should not be speaking out on global issues because we're just located in Asia, I think misunderstands how Australians have always seen the world.
Nothing wrong with speaking out about it. It's just the tone and the talk about creating an embassy in that part of the world where we've never had any diplomatic influence. And moreover, materially, how has the grandstanding affected anything on the ground? Has Russia's conduct, which I would argue has actually been quite reactive and defensive with respect to Ukraine, how has Russia's or Putin's conduct changed in Crimea or eastern Ukraine? It hasn't one bit.
Anna, to get us beyond the kind of wonky talk of embassies and, and troops, I mean, do you want your country to play a role in the world? How do you see these debates?
Well, just on Tony Abbott's contribution, one of, just as a writer, one of his more perhaps creative contributions was the addition of shirt fronting as a verb in international relations. I thought that was quite good. When I read that in the New York Times, I was really dumbstruck by it. I thought it was amazing. And also because it so suits Putin, it would be a language that he would understand. I thought that was quite good. I'm interested, Michael, you talk about a liberal international order by which I'm reading between the lines and the lecture as well, thinking you're talking about the UN system. Because when we talk about liberalism domestically, we're talking about separation of powers and a free press, generally. And just, Anthony, you're asking about in our region, I'm very interested in, for instance, how we manage our relationship with China and our relationship with the US, which you focus on. And you, if you'll forgive me, you say essentially in an optimistic way that it is possible to have our cake and eat it too. And I'm not sure that I'm not sure how that works, and I'd like to tease that out.
So I'm not going to let you off the hook here by asking a question. I want to know from you, a non-foreign policy wonk, role do you want to see your country play in the world? Do you want us to kind of mind our own business, or do you want us to be out in the world, being ambitious and making contributions where we can?
Well, I think there's no option to sit around and mind your own business. That's a sure way to...
Which is not what I'm recommending,
we can't,
by the way.
Yep. It's not a possibility economically or politically or in any way. And I think that... I like very much Michael's discussion of, in a sense, this idea that we're a middling power and how defunct that is, really, or the idea that we've punched above our weight, which is to minimise our very real weight. It is to not take account of the ways in which we're very strong and influential and should continue to be. I was just bringing that question back to the Spratleys, I guess, and the Port of Darwin and a bunch of other things, and just wondering how that is going to play, because that is our immediate area that you're talking about. And the question about liberalism there is how much... So we are a liberal society and China is not. So they are, you know, in control of the stock exchange and the press and the internet and imprisoning writers at a great rate. To what extent does that illiberality or lack of liberalism in China impede what China's going to do, you know, and what it is currently doing, and how does it affect then our response to that? Because our values, for all our differences with the US, are much more aligned with them. We're speaking the same language, not just treaty language, but real language. So how's that going to play? I am allowed to ask some questions.
I'll give you an opportunity to quickly answer that, but then we'll go to the audience with some questions.
Yeah, look, I think that the illiberalism of the Chinese state does matter. I mean, realists like Tom usually say, I don't know what you think, Tom, but they usually say, look, the internal conditions of a country don't really matter. You have to deal with the country as you find it and deal with its foreign policy, and its national interests tend to be enduring. I think the internal character of a country like China does matter, because I think the tightening of conditions in China that we're seeing under Xi Jinping points to a fragility and therefore some uncertainty about the future of where China will go. I think the illiberalism in China, in Chinese political system, probably affects in some degree the character of its external policy as well. And certainly, that's why I think the argument that you sometimes read, that we should tilt away from an historic ally that is still by far the strongest country in the world, with whom we share liberal values, although not an admiration for Donald Trump or the NRA or any of those things, but as Anna says, still, there is much more commonality with the United States and with China. The idea that we would tilt away from the United States towards a country like China with an uncertain domestic future, an uneven foreign policy, seems stark raving mad, to use Tom's formulation. And I think we are much better off, to answer Anna's question, in trying to be clear-eyed about with China. I don't know that we can have our cake and eat it, actually, but the best chance of doing it is to be clear and consistent with China, to of course, cooperate with them when we can, but on issues like the rule of law in the South China Sea, to be absolutely straight, to be clear and consistent with them in stating our policy. I think that's much more likely to promote respect on the part of China towards us than trying to anticipate what it is that China wants us to do and then going along with that. I think that sort of concession to a rising power are much more often pocketed than reciprocated.
In the novel of this story, so we've got the Spratlys, where China is building these islands with, you know, for military purposes and to annoy the US, which it's doing, and for international shipping and so on. So the US is flying extremely close to the 12 nautical mile and over the airspace and so on. In the novel, what happens in this tripartite triangulated situation is that the US says to us, come fly some planes over the Spratlys. That's what happens. Come send some ships. So that's when, because novels are about conflict and drama, that's the conflict and drama. But I think it's not so far-fetched. You know, we have to use our imaginations about how that's going to play, and that's a possible scenario, isn't it? So then it gets more difficult, what you're saying.
I want to take some questions from the audience while we've still got a little bit of time. Raise your hand, tell us who you are, and wait for the microphone if you have a question for any or all of our panellists.
Hello, Lee Argo. I'm a commander in the Navy, and you just had to talk about the Spratlys. We've put in our oar with the US. US haven't signed the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. They're flying at 3 miles away from the land masses. They were doing that illegally before. They've been doing it for a long time illegally. Do we really want to put all our stuff in international policy in with the US?
You want to have a go, Tom, or...?
Well, look, I think Australia is the only country in the world that has supported the United States in every major military intervention since World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now again in Syria and Iraq. And I think the broad consensus in Canberra, both sides of politics, believe that we should give strong support to our American friends in ensuring the freedom of navigation, because these are international waters. And it's not just the United States, it's also many countries in the region. I mean, who would have thought Vietnam, an old Cold War foe of the United States, are clamouring for US security guarantees? Why? Because they're worried about the rise of China. The Philippines, they kicked out the American Navy out of Subic Bay in 1992. They're now clamouring for US security guarantees. So I think that a lot of the countries in the region are very nervous about China's rise, and I think it makes sense for Australia to support the Americans in these freedom of navigation tasks. Getting to the question of whether we should participate and send the Navy and aircraft through the 12 nautical mile zone area, I just think there is a bit of hesitation in Canberra. That's my sense. I'm not sure to what extent we're committed to that. We'll find out in due course. I know that the Americans are putting pressure on us to do that, but we would be the only other country to do so far. And I think what's happening here is that, you know, our history hasn't prepared us for these moments, because since 1901, since our independence from Britain, our foreign policy pretty much has been tied to that of a great and powerful friend, as Robert Menzies used to put it. You know, for the first half of the 20th century, it was Great Britain. And then since the 1940s, and especially since the onset of the Cold War in the early 50s, with the creation of the US alliance, it's been the United States. But now, of course, although the United States continues to be our most important security ally, our most important trade ally is the People's Republic. And I think there's a broad sense, I think the Lowy polling shows this, China is our greatest friend in Asia, just. A lot of Australians believe that we weathered the Asian financial crisis, especially the global financial crisis, a few years ago thanks to Chinese investment. So we now are in this difficult, delicate diplomatic feat of trying to ride two horses simultaneously.
I would just say quickly, we're a maritime country. Much of our trade is seaborne. We have an interest in ensuring that that freedom of navigation continues. So, although it's probably uncomfortable, I mean, if that's the starting point, then there's something in me that's a bit uncomfortable with saying, well, we agree with that, and we're happy we want the United States to conduct these operations, but we don't want to get close to it because there might be recriminations. We have always conducted freedom of navigation operations, including in that area. And I think there's an argument for continuing to do so in the future. I don't think we should do it following a US destroyer. I think we should be doing it on our own recognisance, we should be doing it in our own interests. As for whether there'd be recriminations, I mean, I well remember that, you remember when the Chinese declared an air defence identification zone in the East China Sea, and the Abbott government came out quite strongly against it. And you remember that Julie Bishop got a bollocking from the Chinese foreign minister on TV, which probably wasn't very pleasant. And yet, that didn't stop the Chinese from signing the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement with Australia. So this is why I say sometimes we are constantly self-censoring ourselves and thinking, well, if we do this, China's not going to be happy, and then there's going to be some ill-defined consequences down the track. And I actually think your best position to negotiate with the Chinese is certainly from a position of respect and not trying to create problems for them for the sake of it by any stretch of the imagination, not going in to try to contain China. But at the same point, when we see China behaving in a way that we don't think is consistent with the rule of law or with our interests, I think we have to demonstrate that that's the case. And I think that there is space for us to do that.
Do you want to come in, Anna?
No, I think you said it perfectly.
Okay, great. Up the back there.
Thank you. John Hodges. Just taking us in a slightly different direction, on Monday morning, Prime Minister Turnbull and Mel Gibson fronted the announcement of a large amount of money. They were at the National Institute of Dramatic Art. And one of the tenets of their conversation was that culture was at the centre of everything we do. And then later that afternoon, the announcement of the innovation statement was made. Can you comment on how you see those two things changing or potentially changing the position of Australia in the world?
Maybe start with you, Anna.
Well, I was thrilled about the announcement yesterday in the innovation statement. And there's nothing wrong with looking at Mel Gibson with the Prime Minister outside of NIDA either. But I like very much what Malcolm Turnbull said about culture as about the essence of who we are, because it is. And if we persist in, like today, we've been talking quite a bit about some kind of lack of self-belief. Michael puts it really well. He says, if we talk ourselves down, no one will listen to us. If we take ourselves lightly, we can hardly expect others to take us seriously. That feeds into the tall poppy and all sorts of things. One way of dealing with what looks like a kind of quasi-adolescent lack of self-belief is to have a very strong sense of who we are that doesn't come from a jingoistic, political, Cronulla, you know, Reclaim Australia kind of view, that comes from a very well-rounded knowledge of our history and our culture and our literature. I mean, I'm obviously biased about the literature. But that's where every nation gets its sense of self. So I think it's a very important part of nation building, aside from the intrinsic value of that culture to everyone in our lives. The innovation statement is much more about attracting intelligent venture capital and business investment and high-tech startups, and that's thrilling, absolutely thrilling. We should be, continue to be a very clever and a very rich country. That's how I think.
Michael, one of the things you mentioned, of course, about in terms of sense of self that Anna talks about is a republic.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that why is that important to our sense of self?
Well, I say in the lectures that the republic wouldn't make us a great power, but it would make us it would help to make us a great nation. And what I mean by that is that although I don't think we should become a republic so that other countries respect us more, although I think there would be an element of that. I think there are some countries that wrongly assume that because we continue to borrow a foreign monarch that we're not a completely independent country that's come to adulthood. But I don't really think that that's why we should become a republic, because this is a domestic issue for Australians to decide in our own interest. And to me, we should become a republic not so that others respect us more, but so that we respect ourselves more. And I think until we say we have enough faith in ourselves that we can fill every office under our own constitution, including the highest one, then we're giving something away. And to me, it's obvious. Of course, a self-respecting country wants one of their own as head of state. Of course you want someone who is born here or who emigrated here, who is committed to this country, who has made their lives among us. Why wouldn't you want one of your own as head of state?
Yeah, I mean, we had a Republican referendum in 1999 to determine this issue, and the result was emphatic. The Republicans themselves are very divided between the direct election Republicans and the more minimalist Republicans. And I think, moreover, although Tony Abbott clearly overstepped the mark with the Knights and the Dames, as you pointed out in your book, Michael, and he misread public opinion dramatically, I don't believe there is a hankering in the community to change our constitutional system. I just don't see any real evidence of it. I think, you know, I'll give you an example. There's a course that James Curran, a professor at Sydney University, and I have taught to undergraduates over the years about Britishness in Australian life. And basically the theme is that from 1901 right through to the 60s, Britishness was a central legitimating idea of nationhood. And then those pillars started to collapse with the end of white Australia, Britain's inclusion into Europe, ending tariffs, integrating more in Asia, Privy Council, among other things. And so we've been in an unknown nation, really, since the 60s and the 70s. We're not quite sure what should replace the Britishness as a central legitimating idea of nationhood. And, you know, when I was a student in the early to mid-1990s, the overwhelming consensus among undergraduates was that not only should we be a republic, and remember, this is the height of the Keating-Turnbull agenda, not only should we become a republic, but that it was inevitable within 10 or so years we would be a republic. This was the overwhelming consensus. Well, these days, when you ask undergraduates, they don't particularly embrace the monarchy, although there's a great deal of affection for the Queen, and particularly her grandson and his wife, Kate. But there's also a sense of an agnostic belief about the issue. There's just no real groundswell of support among young people for a republic. And I think to the extent that those attitudes prevail, then there's no real case for changing a system that, all things considered, has worked pretty well for our society and our country's politics for the best part of the century.
A whole other debate.
I'd like to just say something about that. There's going to be a very strong case coming up. So the Republican movement, of which I'm a member, is just starting up again. And I went to lunch yesterday with Peter Fitzsimons, who harangued a room full of us as if we were in a football scrum. So it was good to be home. There are several things that you've said there that I would disagree with. One is that there is some sort of dispute in the Republican movement about what model is required. There isn't. We're not proposing a model. We're just saying that we need an Australian head of state. We're not going to be kind of torpedoed by the idea that it's all too complex and that it involves removing Britishness from our culture, which isn't possible and isn't the issue, or massive constitutional change, which is not the issue either. So it's really good to talk to you because now I know where the arrows are going to be coming from and what they're going to be, so we're all clear.
We're running out of time, but I'm obliged to give the last word to the man who signs my salary checks.
No, I mean, I think, Tom, you put your finger on it when you said that there was huge enthusiasm for this issue when Keating was in office, and that has dulled. And what does that point to? It points to the fact that leadership matters on this issue among many, many other issues. And the truth is the Australian Constitution is diabolically difficult to change. Section 128 makes it very difficult to change the Constitution, and our history of constitutional change shows that unless you have bipartisan support for a change, it won't go through. There was huge enthusiasm for this issue when you had Prime Minister Keating actively making an argument for it. Yes, we had a referendum on it, but the truth is that that referendum question was designed by a dyed-in-the-wool, rusted-on monarchist. The process was designed by a Prime Minister who didn't believe in the Republic. Now we're in a very different situation. We have a Prime Minister who was the chairman of the Australian Republican Movement. In fact, that's how I got to know Malcolm Turnbull back in the day. You have opposition. You'll have Labor leaders forever who are Republicans. So you have a different constellation of factors. And I don't think this is an issue of elites versus leaders versus the public. I think this is an issue of leadership. And when you have a Prime Minister, at some point, I hope soon, who's prepared to make the argument, and you have an opposition leader who's not trying to torpedo it or throw arrows at it, but also making the argument, then I think we might see change faster than you believe.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have run out of time, although I'm sure we could go for at least another couple of hours. It's fitting that this is the last event of the year here at the Lowy Institute. Three really interesting people, lots of big ideas, lots of big debates. It is also our last event in this building as we move down the road as a result of construction work next year. And we'll probably be back here in 4 or 5 years, and I'll probably still be here. But it's been a great pleasure to have you all with us. Michael Fullilove, Anna Funder, and Tom, thank you. And please join me in thanking our guests.